Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo. I'm also known as Miss ADD. I want to welcome everyone to the program today. I'm very excited about this show. We're welcoming today Wendy Bihari, and she's the author of Disarming the Narcissist. This is a book that absolutely saved my life when I was dealing with my own narcissistic husband many years ago, before we separated and got divorced. I had to figure out a way to communicate effectively and put up boundaries, and this book was excellent in helping me to do that. I'm honored to have her on the program. Wendy is, she has co-authored several chapters of articles on schema therapy. Schema therapy was basically invented by Dr. Jeffrey Young, and I've used schema therapy very successfully with a lot of people with ADHD. She has private practice in New Jersey, where she is devoted to treating narcissists, partners, people dealing with narcissists, parenting issues, and couples experiencing relationship problems. So without further ado, I want to bring Wendy on the program. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Justine.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Oh, it's so nice to have you on. As I said to you when we spoke this week, that I'm honored to have you on the show because I am such a fan of yours, and was just talking about the book that you wrote, Disarming the Narcissist, which absolutely changed my life and I'm sure has changed other people's lives in having to deal with narcissistic individuals that are very close relationship-wise.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So we talked about talking today about narcissism and ADD.
Yes.
Avoidance, distraction, detachment, which was great because we did the ADD. So do you want to start off and talk about how you see that correlating with each other?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's not uncommon, or I should say not infrequent, that someone will contact me, and in the midst of describing a narcissistic someone in their life, maybe a partner, usually someone that they have opportunity to spend enough time with, could even be a coworker, but in most cases, it's surrounding a partner relationship. And they'll
right.
ask the question, you know, could this be just a really bad case of ADD? Or could this be narcissism plus ADD? And, you know, until I have a really, as you know, as an expert in the mental health world, until we have a really firm grasp on the person, you know, their real sense of who they are, the behavior, their makeup, signs, symptoms, it's hard to answer that question very quickly. But, you know, the first answer is it could be. Of course it could be. We can have mixed diagnoses. You can have narcissism and ADD. It could be missing the point where there's attentional issues that have just become so frustrated over time that in order to cope more successfully with the limitations, one can develop a kind of entitlement to cover it up. So there's, I guess, the most important thing to start out with is an understanding that all emotional issues or learning issues even, they happen along a spectrum. So not everyone, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. Not every narcissist looks exactly alike, or even every person with ADD. So, you know, I think that what's very stunning about the fact that this question comes up so frequently is because narcissists are notorious for detaching, you know, really mm-hmm. cutting away, looking for stimulating activities and ways to shut down their emotional mm-hmm. world. And that looks like ADD for the most part.
Yes, absolutely. So I have a question about that, because I know a lot of people, we all have this idea of a narcissist and somebody who is constantly in need of adoration.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a spectrum, so depends on where they are. But when you talk
yeah.
about detachment, so can you explain that a little bit more? Because to me or to people listening, that wouldn't be your typical narcissist who's always looking for that adoration.
Yeah, well, I think it's because narcissists have basically, I'm going to say, two primary speeds, if you will, or two primary modes, as we call it in schema therapy. One mode is the one that's very common, classic, what you were just describing, and that is looking for attention, approval, specialness, extraordinariness, superheroes, you know, trying to rise and stand above the rest, always trying to be front and center, sometimes in very charming ways, sometimes in very controlling, obnoxious ways, demanding ways, entitled ways. So that's one mode, and it has a variety of different faces. Then there's the other mode, which we call the detached self-stimulator or self-soothing mode. And that's the mode where they either just zone out, and it's as if you're talking and they're not listening because they're bored. It's not about them. It's about you. It's about your emotions. They don't know how to relate. They don't like the emotional world so much. And so they look for ways to keep their mind busy when they're not in that approval-seeking mode. They go into their detached mode. They'll be workaholics. They'll be gambling. They get addicted to things like drugs and sex and alcohol and shopping and spending and whatever it might be. But they have something that will just keep them preoccupied so that they don't have to feel the vulnerability that's typically very much right there at the core of them. So it's a way of coping, and it's one or the other that you're likely to see.
Yes, and I think it's important for people to understand that even though at times these people can be very difficult to deal with, that at the core of who they are, these are very sad, very...
Yeah, and it's almost unbelievable when people hear this, you know, for the first time around, when I use language like... Because it almost sounds like I'm defending them, which I'm not, but... You know, when I use language like this, you know, your partner or, you know, your child or whoever it might be, you know, at the heart of it all, there's a very insecure person. There's a person who is really suffering. There's a vulnerable side. That's not to make excuses for really nasty behaviors or really off-putting behaviors. It's just to explain that these off-putting behaviors are not, they didn't just show up by coincidence. They didn't show up, you know, by way of inheriting them. They're not biologically driven, even though temperament might play a role in who becomes narcissistic and who doesn't. But we're not born with that kind of, you know, pathologic narcissism. So, you know, there's an explanation to why some people become narcissistic. And very often it's because there is a part of them that's really suffering, this larger-than-life sort of blustering human being. At the bottom of it all is someone who feels incredibly insecure and has developed this amazing way of overcompensating for it.
Right. So
and that's
I told you that in my adult support groups that I run and also with my adult clients, I do use the schemas. And I found them in your book, which was amazing to me that they existed. I didn't know about them at the time. And they've been very helpful in helping people bringing the past into the present and kind of looking at where these came from and how they're still continuing today. So could you talk a little bit for everybody who's listening about what causes narcissism?
Great question. With a couple of answers, because again, it doesn't all come from the same source, but the most classic form that you or I might find in our treatment room, and not typically because they walk in voluntarily, but because they've been, you know, forced to come to therapy or else, but the ones that we're going to see that come to therapy will be those that, you know, they have that classic profile, very demanding, controlling, entitled. It can be loud, it could be soft, it can be very overt, it could be very passive, but it's there. And the background of that is usually someone who has grown up with a kind of confusing message. So you'll find somewhere in the background that there might have been one parent who was very doting, you know, my little prince, my little princess. Usually that parent is living through the child, or that parent relies on the child to be sort of a source for their own ego. So it's not necessarily that the child is getting unconditional love, because in most cases narcissists are sorely lacking in unconditional love. Love usually in their background was conditioned by performance and achievement and super specialness and doing things to please their parents or their whoever their caretakers might have been. And then there's another parent in the picture. This is why it's confusing, where nothing is ever good enough. You know, you could have tried harder. You could have done better. What's wrong with you? Wipe those tears off your face. Be a man. Be strong. Be tough. So the message becomes rather confusing, and the message is almost always linked with performance and achievement. So this idea of connection and just being close to someone and reciprocity and give and take and knowing each other's feelings, it's not part of their repertoire because it's not part of their background typically. Mm. And so you have this, when I say the suffering side, if you picture a little boy or a little girl who has not gotten that kind of love and attention, which we all need as we come into this world, you know, they find ways of compensating for that. They become stellar performers, many of them, or they don't, and then they might turn more to substances. The other one, just to jump ahead for a moment, is the other type is what we call the more pure narcissism, meaning that these are the very spoiled, entitled types that were told from day one that they are extraordinary, that they don't have to play by the rules. It might be a family of status, a family that, you know, where it's generational, kind of the legacy of narcissism from grandparents on down through parents, down through the children, and now they're sitting in your office. Why are they sitting in your office? They got in trouble with the law, and they don't understand why, you know, they have to, they can't drink and drive because they have a very strong constitution. You know, they're more special than most people. So they have this really pure sense of entitlement, often because that's what they were told. You know, no frustration tolerance, someone who was always cleaning up their mess for them when they were growing up, making excuses for them, coming to the rescue for them, never learning how to be uncomfortable, you know, prepared to live in the real world. And then you have those, and then there's one more version, which is a combination of the two, which we also see. You know, the combination of being spoiled and also being not getting that emotional component that's very necessary. Yeah. So those are the origins for the most part.
And what you and I touched a little bit upon this the other day, but what I notice is that in this population, the ADHD population, is a lot of the adults I work with grew up, not only at home, but at school, really hearing negative comments about, you know, they possibly had learning disabilities along with ADHD.
Yeah.
There is also co-occurring depression and anxiety. And so a lot of just negative words that we all heard growing up.
Yeah.
It wasn't like today. I believe it's a gift because we're so creative and we're out-of-the-box thinkers. There's so many positives attached to it. So this could very well be narcissism, as I see it, a co-occurring disorder with ADHD, along with what you said before. It could also be mistaken for ADHD, and it's truly narcissism. But I see it a lot of times co-occurring.
And I'm not surprised, you know, because if you think about something else you and I touched on, and you raised this point, which I thought was a really very keen observation. And at the heart of narcissism, when you think about a word that would capture the essence of their loneliness, because they are lonely people at the end of the day, they don't really know how to connect to anyone intimately for any duration of time or in any real authentic way. The word that captures them is shame. There's a lot of shame. This shame, because if, in fact, they do have ADD, they may be, I mean, as many people with ADD, you just said this, and it's true, they're so bright, so gifted, so creative, so fast on their feet. You know, it's really one of the wonderful things about the way the brain is organized with ADD. And yet, for the longest time, you know, we know for decades and God knows beyond, this was just seen as a deficit. And it wasn't seen at all. It wasn't even understood. So it would just be, what's wrong with you? Pay attention. You're lazy. Why can't you catch on? And if you're growing up in a family that has really super high expectations already, and a family that's trying to live vicariously through you, and parents who really need this for their own sense of self-sufficiency and achievement, then not being able to perform because you haven't been properly assessed for this part of yourself really can lead to this sense of shame. You know, Gabor Maté, who you're probably familiar with, he's from your neck of the woods, wrote this amazing book called Scattered, right? And he talks about this one section in the book that's always unforgettable to me about, you know, shame And just being exposed even to the anger of a parent or the frustration of a parent who doesn't understand a child who's struggling with their attentional issues and becomes angry, the first thing the child is likely to feel is shame. So the toxic element in narcissism, when you combine the two, because again, let's just remember, for the narcissist, it starts with not being not a human being, but a human doing. So it's, what are you doing? How are you achieving? How well are you achieving it? How extraordinary are you? Have to be at the top of the heap. And if it's not about connection. So if it's all about performance, as smart as they might be, they're going to have to really dig in if their attentional faculties are challenged, because they're carrying this big wad of shame around with them and feeling of what we call in schema therapy defectiveness, that they just don't measure up. And that gets taken out very often on a partner or someone else who just happens to be within their grasp. That frustration.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so let's talk about that for a minute, because you see couples. I know you do. And
yeah, a lot.
What do you do when, you know, they come in together and you have a narcissist and then you have someone who is, I don't know, you want to call it the enabler or somebody who is just being emotionally abused by this other person. How do you work with that couple?
Well, given the way the model works primarily, and when I say works, meaning it really is quite effective, not only at working with individuals, but in working with couples too. And so if I have someone come in who has narcissistic issues, and let's say, again, not uncommonly, paired with someone who may be very used to sacrificing their own needs, very used to subjugating their own rights and preferences, and those are just other schemas. So this typical pairing of the two, you have this person who is very, you know, eager to have control over everything and to be very right and righteous, and then you have this other who is very familiar with the idea of giving in and surrendering and forfeiting their needs. Of course, that's the unhealthiest state of the two, but there's strong chemistry there because it's familiar. But over time, as we know, you know, this person, this partner, let's say her, if she's the one who has been sacrificing herself, she starts to, you know, the lights start going on. She starts becoming more, maybe she even got some therapy for herself. She realizes, you know, I deserve more, and this isn't okay with me. And now he's disgruntled because she's breaking the deal, where he gets to, you know, have a say in everything and be the most righteous person in the relationship. And so now they come into couples therapy because she's become strong enough to say, well, if you don't do it, then we're done. Once they come into couples therapy, it's really about getting a grip on the stories, their own stories, what attracted them, what brought them there, not just for once upon a time effects, but for once upon a time appreciation of what is it, you know, that gets activated inside of them. What is it that they're trying to work out that's probably old, that probably has nothing to do with what might be, if there are, strengths in their relationship. What does she obviously will need to continue to be strong enough to keep her leverage, meaning keep those consequences very high, or the narcissist will never change if there's no leverage. And he's going to have to, the therapist is going to have to be incredibly sturdy to make sure that he can see that this is real, these consequences are real, and so he's going to have to drop his guard and become more vulnerable. Start to get to know who she is. Yeah, what it feels like to be her on the inside. And even what it feels like to be him on the inside.
There's that word that is such a powerful word for me, because for years I was incapable of vulnerability. Did not know how to do it. And then began to really get into it after a lot of work I did on myself. And now it's what runs my life, is vulnerability. It's very easy for me, whereas in this world, in my population, the ADHD population, what I notice is they're very protective. They don't, vulnerability scares them, and shame to me is the opposite of vulnerability. So also with the narcissistic, because I'm surrounded by them in my own family as well, that narcissistic way of not being able to show up in a vulnerable way, not being able to to say, you know, I made a mistake or I'm sorry. It's the protection. And, you know, I'm wondering about how do you help them get to that vulnerable place? Do they get there? Can they?
Well, the thing is, when the leverage is high enough, they're typically either very frustrated or angry or both, or quiet, just quiet and detached. And so, as I said, the therapist has to be sturdy enough to really try to translate what's happening behind the scenes. So if I have someone coming in, you know, who says, well, I'm here, aren't I? I showed up, okay? I don't know. She asked me to come to therapy, so I'm here. I don't know. What do you want me to say? You want to talk about my life? You know, my history, is that going to make you happy? I mean, they can be really nasty at times, mm-hmm. very cutting. And I'll say, well, no, not like that. I'd like to get to know you, but clearly you're angry, so I'm wondering what else is going on because your reaction is too intense. So we have to get behind the intensity and make the case that any reaction that's that strong, which is really unwarranted, is obviously telling another story. So what's the story? And it's the persistence of the therapist to not give up and not give in to this and not become intimidated by this, or if you do, to be able to say so, to be able to say, you know, if this is the way you talk to people in your life, then I can understand why you're sitting here in therapy, because frankly, you can be pretty intimidating. But mm-hmm. I understand that with your issues, with your makeup, with what you learned in your life, it's not your fault that you're like this, but it is your responsibility now to do something about it. So we immediately, part of eradicating shame is helping each individual appreciate that this is all a part of memory. You know, we learn things, we store them, and then they're retrieved under certain conditions where the brain is reminiscing, and we don't even know it's happening. So when they learn this, when narcissists learn that this is just part of the way the whole system works, they can drop their guard a little bit and feel less shame. And when they show me some of that vulnerability, I applaud it and I welcome it. And it becomes ultimately a relief to be able to not always have to be in a performance mode and to just be.
So
that's part of the
thing. So you and I say the same things. I say it a little differently. I talk about, you know, being able to stay focus during the day. And I do it with meditation and mindfulness, but also in working through the schemas. When my stuff gets hit during the day, my stuff, I'm able to say, wait a second, I know what schema that gets from. I don't need
to deal
with that. I've already dealt with it. I can move on with my day.
That's great. That's very advanced, though, right? That's very advanced because it means you've done a lot of work to really be quick to sense and identify and know that this is like an old story that's invading the premises.
Exactly.
And so you label it?
Yes. I label it because I know, like, for example, one of my things is growing up being blamed for things I did not do, whether it was at school with the nuns, the Catholic school, or at home.
Ooh,
and, you know, again,
too, okay.
I'm 61, so it was many years ago, all right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still today. It can hit me pretty hard if somebody tries to say, well, you know what, you did that, and I know I didn't do it. I get the schema that it activates, and I have to just kind of take a deep breath and say, I've already dealt with this. I can move on. This isn't my childhood. Mm-hmm. I'm an adult. I can handle this. But as you were just saying, this takes a lot of work. And it takes, you know, a lot of time. And if you're willing to get better and effort, putting the effort in and the work, then you can get better. And what I notice is I don't get wrapped up during the day in those stories from the past because I can stay in the moment.
That's great. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah,
it is
doable.
I mean, you're like living proof. You can say to anyone listening that, you know from your own experience that this can happen. It's a lot of work. It's very painful. We do have to look at the reality of our experiences that are sometimes very painful. For people who have struggled with the effects of having ADD and not being understood and being misrepresented and developing coping strategies that, you know, at the time were perhaps helpful because it's all you can do when you're a kid. There isn't much you can do. But now in the, you know, in the here and now, maybe actually harmful. When you can figure all of that out and really put the time and effort into caring for yourself that way, there is a chance to be able to arrive at a moment and say, that was then, and this is now, and it's okay now. I can take care of this.
And do you notice, because I notice in the ADHD population, I talk a lot about emotional individuation growing up, emotionally. Most of us look like adults, but I can promise you I didn't grow up till I was 54. Because of starting all this work that I was, you know, because I became vulnerable and said I have to do this work. Do you notice in the narcissistic world that emotionally that they are stuck in their childhood or adolescent years?
Well, what you'll notice is that, you know, when we think in terms of schemas, right, so we think about traits that come up under certain conditions, and we think about states that happen, emotional states. So we know that we all have, if you're an adult, even if you're an adult who's had a lot of issues, you've been very wounded, you probably have maybe a sliver of healthy adult that shows up enough to help you to get dressed and get to work and maybe make some thoughtful decisions. So it's a matter of how much healthy adult is on board. And healthy adult means person with balance, flexibility, and emotional capacities, can say, I'm sorry, can be responsible, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think that with narcissists, we see them so often in these states that have become habituated, where they're demanding, they're controlling, they're seeking approval, or they are heavily involved, maybe overcompensating obsessively, compulsively even, on getting things right, perfect, the best. Just really invested in their work or in whatever their addiction or obsession might be. And some of that might come out of having this coexisting ADD, so they work harder. It's like they haven't realized, I already passed that course. I know how to do this. I've already aced it. I don't have to keep doing it. They get stuck, to use your word, in this behavior that has, you know, for the most part, served them well as a kid, but now it's driving everybody away in their life as an adult.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, we can laugh, but for the most part, for the person on the receiving end of that, it can be devastating, and especially when there's kids involved as well, which is something I'd really like you to talk about. One of the things that I notice, and maybe you're noticing this too, is the pendulum has swung pretty far to the other side in terms of raising children. There's so much entitlement and so much of, you know, this is the perfect little person. And I live in an area that is pretty affluent, and there's a lot of alcohol and drug abuse, as there is all over the country. But right now I'm just talking about this area. And I notice that a lot of excuses are being made. And I wonder if you could give some advice to some of the parents that are listening about how important boundaries are when you're raising your children and giving them the gift of frustration, because everything today is immediate gratification, texting, the phones, the iPads, the computers. And, you know, the example I always use is when I was growing up, I had to wait a whole year to watch The Wizard of Oz.
That's right.
Nowadays, we can get it in a second. So there's no self-soothing or learning how to feel frustrated. And I wonder if you can speak, because I think that's the making of a lot of different pathologies, but one in particular may be narcissism. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit to the parents.
You've made so many good points in that one piece that you just spoke, Justine. And on the one hand, the times have evolved to such a degree, technologically speaking, that it's a little scary. We have to wonder about even just language and empathy, you know, being able to read someone's facial expression and gestures and tone of voice and language and appreciate what they're experiencing, because so much has become about you know, words in a text or an email, or it's a photograph that's been taken that where you look your best, or you look like you have 5,000 friends. So, I mean, there's technology is a beautiful thing, right? We all like it. We all like our technology. But I do worry, because I think my advice to parents today would be do the best, do whatever you can to allow for those opportunities for your child to learn how to tolerate being uncomfortable, because the world is just filled with opportunities out there, despite technology and even with technology, to be frustrated and uncomfortable. And we need to be able to learn how to wait our turn and not go crazy just because, you know, we have to wait a few extra minutes for someone who's maybe trying to figure something out on our behalf. To be reciprocal, you know, that whole idea of just give and take and sharing. I mean, imagination. God knows what's going to happen to the whole art of the imagination, which is also
so
a worrisome thing to me. Yeah, it really is. And so, you know, I say to parents, try to create, at least carve out. I know it's hard. I think parenting is really hard. I'm a parent, too, and but I think it's really hard now, because you don't want your child to be completely alienated from what's going on in the world and isolated from their peer group. But how do you keep the balance so that they're still learning how to live in a world where frustration isn't going to go away, being uncomfortable, making an effort, sharing, reciprocity? How do we keep that stimulated? Look for ways in which you can keep that going, keep that growing within your child's personality. It will be one of the greatest gifts, I think, in the end, if we can keep that part, you know, alive.
I agree. And the biggest issue for me in dealing with, you know, adolescents and young adults is this whole idea, which I just mentioned, but I'm going to bring it up again, is there is nothing we have to wait for today. There's very little.
Right.
And so somehow I encourage parents to figure out a way to develop that. So let them work towards something. If they want, if they want a video game, if they want to go to the movies, if they want, you know, a dress or a pair of shoes, don't just run out to get it for them. Figure out a way for them to work for it where it's a positive thing.
Yeah, where they can feel some sense of their own investment,
where they can
feel some pleasure and pride, and also that balanced by still enjoying your child just for their little idiosyncratic ways, without them doing anything at all. So, you know, that whole idea of just loving them for them, delighting in their creativity, in their silliness, being able to use discipline appropriately so that discipline doesn't assassinate their character but might still be teaching them some life lessons if they're, you know, being thoughtless or careless with someone. So there's so many things that we want to – it's hard. You know, it's a lot of things to focus on, but it is so critical to trying to preserve, you know, that sense of just – I hate to say mastery because it sounds so performance-oriented, so let's call it a kind of mastery where it becomes innately comfortable to be among other people. You can raise a child who might be bright enough, or you have enough resources to help them really move it along into the best and the most wonderful of schools and academic settings, but that isn't necessarily going to guarantee happiness in the end. So happiness and prosperity and well-being is really going to come from a child who is interpersonally capable.
Yes. Thank you for saying that. Because there's so much today about grades, and it's the same type of education that we started with during the Puritan age when the colonists first came over here. And this isn't everybody sitting in a desk, and, you know, not everybody learns that way. And so when I have parents who get crazy because their child isn't getting A's, I always talk to them about effort, you know. You know, I used to say my boys when they left every day for school, guys, school is what you do. It is not who you are. Huge difference.
That's great.
You and I know people who we define ourselves by our big houses and our cars and not by what's inside. And I think that's kind of what's missing a little bit in society today. And you just said it. Just because you you go to Harvard or, you know, you go to Yale or you have straight A's doesn't mean that you're going to be a happy individual.
Right.
If
or
you
someone
don't
who
develop
anybody
that
wants to
insight.
Even hang out with.
Exactly.
Right.
And so this brings me to something that I personally struggle with, and I know a lot of other people, I'm sure, that are listening do. So having a child who has narcissistic tendencies, may have the personality disorder, not sure exactly what, you know, is going on with everybody who's listening, but that's tough. To me, that's even tougher than dealing with a spouse who I already dealt with. You can always get rid of the spouse if you have to.
Yeah.
I don't mean to sound so cold, but that can happen. For me, he wasn't the father of my children, which was perfect. So he could go away and I never had to deal with him again. But when you have a child who you love, you want to do everything to help that child. Can you give us all some advice on what do we do with a child who is exhibiting these narcissistic tendencies and doesn't have empathy and is having a hard time in the world, and we're watching it and dealing with us?
Yeah, good question. And let's differentiate, because this also raises another point, and then I will certainly answer that question, but let's differentiate between the kind of narcissism that is natural as part of development and the kind of narcissism where I think you're referring to, Justine, which is where you see the red flag is beginning to go up and you're going, uh-oh.
Let's talk about the natural one. That's very good because a lot of times people don't understand that it is natural to have some narcissistic tendencies. Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, we come into the world. We're so helpless and needy. We're naturally narcissistic when we arrive in the world. We go through this phase of, you know, complete confusion and some disillusionment and wanting to be our own people in adolescence. I mean, Dan Siegel's book called Brainstorm, another fabulous read on adolescence, helps us to really appreciate not only the turbulence but the magic of adolescence. And I think, so there's some natural tendencies to show up in these what would be called narcissistic ways as part of development. But that's really different from what I would call the burgeoning narcissist, the one that's starting to blossom into a young adult who's going to have some issues. And I think a parent who still has a child who is of a minor, you know, where you have them living under your roof, where you have some, well, you still have leverage, you know. I mean, choices and consequences becomes a very important couple of words to add to the vocabulary for your child, that you can make this choice and you'll have this consequence. So it's not so much about punishment and penalty. It's about learning another life lesson. It's about preparing your child to live in the world. You see them starting to become, you know, they're displaying narcissistic tendencies that are problematic. And it's never too late to say, I love you and I'm worried, and we're going to change things around here because I want you to be as prepared to live in this world as you possibly can be, because that's my job and it's because what I want most of all for you. And so you can make choices, but there will be consequences. Some of them will be really good consequences and some of them will be ones you won't be so happy with, but they are going to happen. And don't say it unless you're really ready to install it. And if you can't install it, then get some help to figure out why not. What's getting in your way?
And I loved the way you just put that. I love you. I mean, starting off conversations with a positive, they hear that. There isn't, the defenses don't go up, telling them you love them, so you want to give them boundaries. You want to give them, you know, situations where they can grow through, because there is tons of entitlement that I'm seeing at very young ages, and I'm scared for these children that they're going to go out into this world and this is going to grow, you know. And then, like myself, I happen to have a son who's not living with me; he's off up in San Francisco, so it's more difficult. Even, you know, I say to him,
"That's really
hard."
Yeah,
it's very difficult because I'm a therapist, so I see the behaviors, and he's also 20 months sober. So, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? We're not sure. I know he struggled so much with my ex-husband, and that is very, very sad. But, you know, how to get through to them, I guess, is my question. And I do know that there are people on Facebook that have brought up situations like this. How do you get them to hear you saying, I love you, something has to change for you because I'm seeing these red flags that scare
me. Something just like that, except it's a strategy that we call empathic confrontation. And it's a really beautiful strategy because it combines the idea of empathy, meaning I know you. And empathy, remember, empathy isn't sympathy. Empathy is not compassion. Empathy is I get you. I may not like you. I may not like what you're doing, but I get you. I can make sense out of you, out of what you're doing. So if you're looking at your adolescent child, you know, who's beginning to harvest these narcissistic traits, you can say, and they're not used to this, because let's say you've been in the middle of, you know, some ongoing hell yourself, so you've not been able to address it adequately, then you pick up a book or you listen to a great radio show, or, you know, you get some help, and suddenly your eyes are wide open. What do? You go home and you announce it, like out of the clear blue. You can just say, look, I love you. My eyes are open to this. You're going to roll your eyes. Here's the empathy. We know adolescents. Most of them, especially with narcissistic traits, you say, I love you, they're going to roll their eyes. Yeah, right. I care about your well-being. Yeah, I know. Right. Now all of a sudden you care about my well-being. They can be nasty. They can come back with lines that push our buttons. So you have to practically pre-rehearse and anticipate what you're likely to hear so that you can preempt it. So you can step up and say, I know you're going to roll your eyes. I know you're going to think this is crap. I know this is going to make you feel like, oh, you know, what'd she do, read some new book? And so I know that might be your response. And here's the thing. I don't care. Because I love you, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to tell you anyway that things are going to be different. Because I want you to be prepared to live in this world and to be happy. And I can't do it any other way. And so that's the way it's going to be. And you can be angry. You can be frustrated. You can be completely confused right now. That would make sense to me, too. But it is going to be different. So it's a very solid track. It's calm. But it also comes with a kind of enlightenment. Like, I know what you're going to feel. I see you. I know you. You know, and it's basically saying, and, you know, we can if you want to talk about how that's going to look or why I'm doing this, fine. But there isn't really going to be any room for negotiating it as a philosophy, because your life and your health and your well-being is not negotiable.
So what does a parent do? Or even let's even talk about a couple. So somebody in the family you're seeing some narcissism, you're seeing the controlling behavior, you're seeing your codependent behavior with that person, be it your child or your husband or your father, your mother, whoever it is. How do you get that person? Because I know these are tough people when it comes to therapy, because it's everybody else, it's not them.
Right.
Most of the time.
That's right, right. Maybe you're the one who needs help, they'll say. Never them.
Yeah, it's my favorite. So how do you get them to see, even to see, that they may need some help?
Well, again, anticipate that they won't see that. I mean, if they do, then, you know, oh, happy day. You know, you've just maybe hit the nail on the head. Maybe they've hit a rock bottom. Maybe something has finally really been the leveraging piece that was necessary. Maybe a girlfriend or a boyfriend broke up with them. Something happened that got them to see the light of day. But in most cases, it's not that easy. You really have to get into that space where you can anticipate they're not going to be happy about the idea of getting help. So you have to ask yourself a really important question. What am I prepared to absolutely enforce if they refuse? Don't come up with something that you're not prepared to do. This happens all too often with partners even, who will say, you know, if you don't get some help, we're done. Okay, so now the narcissistic partner takes that kind of seriously, may come into therapy for a little bit, but now gets wise enough to start going home and saying, look, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this anymore. You want to leave? Go ahead and leave. And they call their bluff. And now the one who issued the ultimatum gets scared because they have abandonment schema. So they have abandonment issues. And the moment the narcissist starts to, you know, call back on them, that's it. No, you know, it's fine. You don't really have to go to therapy. And so you don't want to be wishy-washy with your leverage. You got to make sure you use leverage that actually you can enforce. And if you're not ready to enforce a calling it quits, which a lot of people aren't, that was part of the reason I wrote the book, then don't say that. You can say, you know, I really do see that somewhere down the road we're going to come apart. And that can be enough to stimulate fear and something meaningful in the narcissist to do what they have to do, even if they don't want to do it. But at least it gets the ball rolling. Then the harder part, truly, this is true, sadly enough, but you probably know this too, is to find a therapist who is equipped to work with them.
Absolutely. And I have to ask you that question too, because I know you're in New Jersey, and you can hear my accent, so I'm originally from New York. But it's interesting because out here, I have myself Googled, you know, narcissistic experts and all that, and it's kind of like I'm having a hard time finding someone for people that need some help in those specific areas because they're not specific to, it's like they have all the, everybody just thrown into this, these different websites, and I don't know how to navigate, and I'm sure everybody who's listening would like to know, how do I go and talk to somebody if I'm a narcissist and I need some help? And your book is tremendous at being able to help people talk to a narcissist and communicate effectively. But what else can people do to find an expert in the area?
Well, first of all, thank you for your nice words about the book. I appreciate that. It is so hard, but I would say this, be a really brave and open mouth consumer when you're looking for a therapist. Don't be afraid.
Okay.
You know, this is an expensive endeavor for people to buy into therapy. You don't want to be with someone who tells you, yes, I have a lot of experience. That's great. But what's your specialty? How do you work with narcissism? Ask them, what's your approach? You know, how will you work with them? Tell me exactly. I've coached so many people on how to be a good consumer of therapy when they go out there. If I don't know someone in the geographic location where they may contact me and say, do you know somebody in, you know, wherever? And I say, oh, unfortunately, I don't have any connections there. But here's some good questions you absolutely want to ask when you start shopping for your therapist. And then I give them, you know, a whole list of questions to ask about what's the approach? How do they work with narcissists? What is their style?
Right.
And you don't want
right.
to hear things. You don't want to hear things like, you know, well, I'm very supportive. No, that's great. But how do you work on change, right? Because support is a nice thing, but how do we work on change? How do you formulate treatment goals? How do you conceptualize? How do you look at human beings? What is your general, you know, what is your basic religion in psychotherapy? What was your training? That is not
these
intrusive.
These are great questions. And the other thing is, and I've told clients this myself, because I will do this, and I'm sure, I don't know if you will, but I believe that you can make an appointment. You don't have to take the full hour just to kind of see if there's a connection and can you work with that person? Will that you feel like that person is good for you.
Right.
I don't think there's anything wrong with people asking for that. Can I come in, you know, and see you and stay for 10, 15 minutes and just get a feel for, you know, what you do and how you do it instead of on the phone? Sometimes people can't tell on the phone, is this going to be a good match for me?
Absolutely can't. The phone may not be enough. And you may not want to invest all the money in a full session or even in five full sessions. So you can ask for, could I have an abbreviated consultation session with you? Now, I'll go one further. I think a really good therapist will also be saying to you, consultation session, let's make sure we are a good fit for each other. Because a good mm-hmm. therapist will also decide whether or not they feel they have what it takes to treat
yep.
the problem. And I respect a therapist who can say, I like you, I wish I could help you, I don't feel like I have what it takes to be
right.
able to help you effectively.
Right. Yes, and you're talking to one of those therapists, because I will do that. If
good.
I have people
good.
Come in, I don't work with people with personality disorders. I'm not psychodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
I work with in
mm-hmm.
the world of ADHD, and if I feel like there's somebody that comes in that is struggling with that, I will refer them out and tell
mm-hmm.
them, you know, I wish you the best, and it's just I'm not going to be effective for you. We
mm-hmm.
can't be everything to everybody, and I think this is a really good thing to say, because there's a lot of people out there, a lot of therapists out there who are wonderful, and there's also a lot of therapists who will take on anybody who comes through the door, and they're not capable of helping
right.
them. So I
right.
think
and,
that's
and
really important.
And you won't
important.
Know that. As a client, you're not
no.
going to know that right away until, you know, a lot of time has passed, a lot of money has been spent, and suddenly you're realizing, nothing's happening here.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
And you're working hard. It's not because you as the client aren't working hard. You're working very hard. You're doing everything that's been asked of you, and it just doesn't seem to really be touching anything meaningful. There's no emotion involved in the process. And let's say this. I started out trained as a cognitive therapist. I then
okay.
got involved in the world of schema therapy and its development, which is a very integrative model. So it incorporates a lot of different schools of thoughts in a very thoughtful way. But, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, transformation and change. It's out there in the data. It's out there in the evidence-based models that show that if there's no emotion coming up, if you're not working with emotion, you're not likely to get lasting change.
Right.
So if your therapist
is
chatting with you, that's nice, but it's not necessarily going to breed any change that's enduring.
That's what I was just going to say is, there's so many people that will go to therapy just to tell stories, but that
yeah.
pain that comes up, they just really don't want to feel it. And,
yeah.
you know, there's no growth without pain.
Right.
One of my favorite books is The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. And my favorite chapter in the book is Pain, the Price of Freedom.
Mm.
I mean,
yeah.
It's what it's all about. So, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about that. I have some questions from some people who they post them on my website.
Okay.
And so I'm going to read these to you and you can answer them. How is narcissism detected in women in a relationship?
How is it detected in women? You mean, does the question mean female narcissists?
Yes, yeah.
Well, you know, women can show up, as I sometimes will call it, like the diva princess. I mean, they can give the male counterpart narcissist a run for their money, and so they sometimes look very much the same. They're very
okay.
self-righteous, they're all-knowing, and then there is some distinct differences, though, with male and female narcissism that I've come to see, and that is that with females who are narcissistic, you're more likely to get the martyr types. In other words, you know, oh, you think you've had it bad? Wait till I tell you how bad I've had it. So their pain is always greater than everybody else's pain.
I don't mean to laugh.
Their
but...
challenge is greater. Their misery is greater. Their joy is greater. Everything, you know, everything is just bigger and wilder and greater or worse or more painful than anybody else's. And so you'll get that kind of, or I wouldn't do something like that. I know other people might, but
mm-hmm.
never me. So you're getting this sort of passive-aggressive kind of judgment attached to everything so they can be kind of holier. I call them, you know, the virtuous victims. Their virtue is their victimhood in some ways. Now, I'm not saying that without empathy for their suffering, because
right.
I do think there's a suffering
right.
attached to all of this, too. It's just sometimes harder to see it.
And do you notice, because part of this question is also, which I think is brilliant, is related to borderline versus narcissism, because a lot of times this person's asking, how do you tell the difference? in women, because borderline seems to show up more in women, although I know it can absolutely be, you know, be carried by men as well.
Yeah.
But they're asking, how do you tell the difference? I think that's a pretty good question.
It's a very good question. It's a very important question, I would say, more than anything, because, you know, when you're talking about borderline pathology, you are really talking about someone who likely suffered some pretty serious traumatic events in their life.
Yeah.
Usually including abuse, neglect, abandonment, things that have been pretty painful, sexual abuse in many cases. And so what might look like angry, entitled, you know, little spoiled brat may actually be an angry little girl who perhaps for the first time feels safe enough to express that anger with someone in her life. Now, I'm not saying that that's okay and they should be allowed to rant and rave about things. That's not okay, and it hurts relationships. But when they are triggered and they feel comfortable enough to do so, you may see this anger that just needs to find a place to be ventilated. And so it may happen, ironically, in the relationships they feel safest to do it. And they will get mistaken for being narcissistic or entitled, when in fact, in those moments, they're about 3 or 4 years old. That's
so
what they're
sad.
Experiencing. Yeah, so it's very sad, and the help of a therapist can really be immense and wonderful, because they need that safe place where they can grieve and they can vent anger for these really old, painful wounds, and
really
grow their healthy adult part.
Yeah. Are the schemas also used in borderline?
Oh,
borderline?
Sure. Yeah, we have a whole model that's been tested, so it's evidence-based. We have a beautiful study in a psychiatric journal from 2006. You can find it on my website. It's on working with borderline personality and schema therapy. And,
wow.
So the whole model developed around that, along with, you know, working with narcissism.
Oh, that's awesome. I just saw them in your book for narcissists. I didn't know you were using them with borderlines, because I know they use DBT with borderlines. I actually also use DBT workbook with ADD, because one of the executive function deficits is emotional dysregulation. I mean, we can just go to you know, 0 to 150 in a second. So it's a great workbook. So, and then to go on for a minute, another part of this question is, what is the line between caring and being taken advantage of? So I guess in a couple, you know, caring and then somebody taking advantage of you. What's that line look like?
It's a very personal decision. You know, a lot of people will ask, am I being a sucker? And I'll say, you're not being a sucker. If you're making a decision with your eyes wide open that you can live with and you don't feel resentful about, because it's really your decision. You know, women will say to me, they've been saying this for the longest time, am I just an idiot to put up with this? I'll say, well, I don't think there's anything idiot about you. Most people who have this love in their heart for someone who's wounded and tolerate a lot aren't usually stupid people. They're just people who are accustomed, either learned how to take too much responsibility in their life so they own everybody else's problems. That doesn't make you an idiot. It's just something you're used to. But there's also this thing called, you know, making decisions with your eyes wide open. And as long as it's not coming from a schema-driven place, meaning like it's not coming from a, I have no choice, I have to do this or else. It's, look, I know that this isn't fair to me, but I do want to preserve the relationship. I'm not going to do it at any price. But for now, while, you know, he or she is getting some help, I'm willing to make some sacrifices. That's not being an idiot. That's not being foolish. That's not being, you know, just a silly enabler. That's making a very conscious decision, and maybe it's a test. Maybe it's part of an experiment. It's okay to conduct experiments, because relationships, you know, they're serious. They're important, and very often there's children's lives at stake, too.
Yeah. And I would
think
when
somebody's... So I like to help people who worry about that.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people that worry about it. But I think one of the things that's important is boundaries. And when you're in a relationship like that, there has to be healthy boundaries.
Yes.
To me, that's the difference between caring and being taken care of, advantage of as well. You know.
Yeah, and some people, some of us, you know, we may not see it. If you're really used to being the one who always kind of puts yourself on the back burner, until
mm-hmm.
you're with a good friend or a therapist or someone who really sees it, watches the pattern, and can see it, they might say, you know, because I've had clients who will say to me, but I really don't mind. It's really okay. And I'll say to them, you know, I know you feel that. I just worry for that little girl inside of you who all her life has lived in this way. When is it her turn, you know, to get what she needs? When's it okay for her to say, I matter too? My needs matter too. Because I'm thinking and sensing her. And I wonder while, you know, the adult part of you might say, well, look, it's okay, I can tolerate it. What about the other parts of you emotionally that have spent your whole life taking care of everyone else with no one there for you?
Right.
So sometimes the therapist has to be a spokesperson for that vulnerability because there is no one else who can do that.
No. And that's sad, too.
Yes. Yeah.
So then this another person wrote and asked about, what are the signs or red flags when you have a youngster or, you know, an early adolescent growing up in terms of narcissism? What would be red flags or signs for that?
You have to look for exaggerated, I sometimes say look for exaggerated behaviors when it comes to no ability to tolerate frustration, right? So all adolescents will struggle some because their brains are really in turbulent states for the most part. They're losing
right.
their resilience by way of changes in the brain. They lose their this hormonal compromises. So, and they can go adrift. If you add to that an adolescent who's also dealing with attentional issues like ADD, then you have a bit of a, you know, an interesting little bonfire in there. But you want to look for exaggerated things, like really getting, you know, highly agitated when they can't get something done. And they may need a lot more encouragement. You want to look for a real sense of, a real lack of remorse. You know, they do something that offends someone and they have absolutely no remorse. No capacity, because I think once we hit adolescence, it's not unreasonable to expect our children to be able to sit back for a moment and imagine what it would be like to be in that person's shoes.
Mm.
Now, as a little child, they can't do that so easily. Some kids do. But
right.
an adolescent, they'll kind of balk at that, but this is where discipline becomes very important, where a parent is asking that question over and over again. Well, what if it were you? How would you feel? Can you imagine how it felt to me when you said that? What if it had been said to you? So it's really teaching them the skills to stop and empathically address these issues.
Wow.
And again, the problem for narcissists is that they can't say I'm sorry, because saying I'm sorry is like calling themselves dirt. You know, where a healthy person can say, you know, a healthy person can say I'm sorry because they know that we all make mistakes. It happens. It doesn't mean I'm horrible, you know. But a narcissist can't say I'm sorry because it's like saying I'm horrible, and they can't.
No, and they're
that
really
feeling.
Good at throwing it back onto you, whatever it is that you're saying. And
they have
I think,
to, right?
Yes, yes, and I think is any kind of relationship, whether it's a parent or it's a couple or it's a mother or father, what you know that you're dealing with, whatever it is, you have to definitely have some armor to be able to take that, but at the same time, to be able to calmly, as you talk about, and is how I address my life now also, calmly talk about how that just made you feel.
Yes, that's right. Without just focusing on how to make them feel bad about themselves, that's not the goal. The goal is not to, so again, think about the empathic confrontation strategy. I can say to my child, look, I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm not saying that you meant to be harmful or hurtful, but it was hurtful in the end. So we have to figure out what was going on inside of you that made you react that way, because that was really hurtful. You know, oh, you're just so sensitive, you know. You say, well, maybe, you know, because narcissists are, I mean, adults or adolescents will be famous for saying, they throw it back at you, you're just so sensitive. And I often respond like this if they say that to me in session. I'll just say, well, if you really do think I'm so sensitive, wouldn't you be more careful? And then they don't know what to say, right?
That's great.
You know, so I do think it's really about helping them to see. I don't think you're a bad person, but I do think something got triggered in you to react
mm-hmm.
that way, because your reaction was a bit strong, and it really was a bit harsh. And what is so hard about saying, you're right, and I made a mistake, and I'm sorry for that. I didn't really want to hurt you.
I think, you know, it's interesting because I can go back to my time in my 20s when I remember having to say I'm sorry to people back then. And when you just said that, I could feel that pushback when I was that age of not be, because I felt like I was going to be viewed as a terrible person. And so I just had to do whatever I could to stop that from coming out of my mouth. Or if it did come out of my mouth, there wasn't an authentic thing about it. So,
and you know what? That's beautiful. And that's important. So just a quick note on that. When it's not, it won't be authentic. So don't expect it from your kids to be authentic. It's still about learning the skills. Here's what happens. Your adolescent says, okay, fine, I am sorry. Yes, I see your point. I know it wasn't nice of me to do blah, blah, blah. And you as the parent look at them and say, I really, really appreciate that. That's so meaningful to me when you say it. So thank you for saying it. Now they roll their eyes, but guess what? That's meaningful to them. Because it's the opposite of what they expected. Like you just said so beautifully, I couldn't say I'm sorry at that stage because I feel like, you know, I'm going to look really bad and I'm going to feel really bad. But the irony is that when you apologize and someone really applauds you for being so thoughtful in your apology, you've just prepared your child to live in the world and know how to say I'm sorry to someone and
how
to be appreciated.
That's powerful.
So that's the idea. You want to really, and I do this with my narcissists who are, you know, in their 40s, 50s, and 60s in treatment. These are guys who are these big, larger-than-life guys who will come in, and all of a sudden, you know, progress is measured in these little tiny steps. So suddenly they come in and say something that's a little off-putting, and they'll look at me and say, you know, I'm sorry, that wasn't really a very nice thing for me to say. That probably felt offensive. And I say, wow, thanks. That is really thoughtful of you. That is so sweet of you to take that so seriously. And they roll their eyes like an adolescent and say, oh, my God, it's just an apology. I say, no, it's really much more than that. But now they want to apologize all the time because it's this way of just being, you know, which for you or me might just come naturally.
Yeah.
But for them, it is like it's like living in a new planet.
Yeah, because now it's natural for me. But years ago, I can go back there, and I can tell you that years ago, it was not. So I understand that. So that being said, how can I say this? What started you off working with narcissists? That's interesting.
There's the question.
Yes.
You know, I think probably the truth is this. It's not as kind of soap opera interesting as some people would like to think, but I, as a very young new therapist, you know, thinking that we know everything right up front because we've done all this studying and preparing, and I started meeting clients. I literally would meet. It's like what I said in the introduction of my book. I met a client who had me so frozen in my tracks.
Yeah, I remember that.
I was so triggered that I was literally like the little girl back in the 60s in Catholic school, feeling like I'm in trouble with the nuns, because you know how it was back then, right? You were either the good soldier or you were the kid getting beaten up and punished. I was a good soldier. So here I was now being addressed by this narcissist. I didn't even understand narcissism at the time. I'm being addressed by this narcissist in this really callous and scary way, and I'm finding myself apologizing, and I didn't do anything wrong, and agreeing with things I didn't agree with. And I said, this is wacky. I am feeling like I'm about 6 years old. So I got curious and started with the help of Jeff Young, who was at that time my mentor, now my dear friend.
Wow.
we started exploring it together and really looking at the activation of my own schemas, my own story. It was a fascinating journey for me and turned into my expertise, because the truth is it was just so rewarding to figure out how to help them. And it made me better, because I had to get strong. I had to get sturdy to do it.
That's incredible. And to have Jeffrey Young as a mentor is amazing.
Pretty special, yeah.
Yeah, very special, yeah. Mm-hmm. So then somebody else is asking, what are the signs or traits to look for when trying to identify a narcissist when you're dating?
Ooh, good question.
Yeah.
I love this question, because whenever I work with people who've come out of relationships with narcissists, their biggest fear is, I'm going to pick another one. I'm like a magnet for them. And I'll say to them, well, here's the thing to keep in mind. When you're out dating someone, if you want to watch out for narcissism, and you could miss it, let's face it, we're all, you know, we can all be deceived. Narcissists can be so charming. And they're so good in the courtship phase. Remember, they know how to perform. They know how to win people over. That's not to say they're all shallow. Some of them are actually very loving people, but they get uncomfortable in that space. So they use it more for performance than to allow themselves to really be intimate. So you have to be careful, because we can all get swept away by the charm and the allure.
Right.
But you want to look for this. Do they make eye contact? Do they ask questions about you? And do they listen to the answers? Do they interview you when they're asking questions? So it's more like a checklist, you know. So where'd you go to school? So where did you live before that? So what did your parents do? So where did you grow up? So what's your favorite ice cream? That sounds interesting. They're asking a lot of questions, but nothing is tied together, so that when you say, well, I grew up in this lovely little rural town, I miss it. You know, I live in the city now, and I really miss that life. They don't say, oh, tell me more about the rural town. What was that like? No, they're on to the next question. So where did you go to school?
So there's no intimacy
with your feelings. No intimacy, no connecting with your feelings. Now, a lot of people might be listening and going, come, give me a break. It's a first date, you know. And I would say, okay, maybe not on the first date, although I would start to be, you know, paying a lot of attention if that's the first date and I'm not getting any sense. Forget about even being, you know, really gooey, but just to show some interest in the way I'm saying things. You know, you're sitting with someone, you know the difference. You sit with someone who's having a conversation with you, and they have this ability to be able to look at you and say, well, you look really happy when you talk about that. That must have been a fun time in your life. They're paying attention to you. They're not just listening to the words that you're saying.
Right. So
this is what we want to look out for.
So if you don't mind, I'd like to give a big red flag to people who are dating. And I had this big red flag when I dated my ex-husband. And one of the things is controlling. Okay, so I was late meeting him for lunch at a restaurant in Manhattan. This is a crowded restaurant. I was a half an hour late. I was working at Bloomingdale's at the time as a buyer, and I had been at my warehouse. And you know New York traffic.
Oh, yeah.
He screamed at me in the crowded restaurant and told me never to disrespect him like that again.
Oh, my God.
So and so instead of just putting my track shoes on at that point and getting out, I stayed because I made excuses. Well, that was my fault. I was late. I shouldn't have been late. So I have written a book about this, but I have not even, you know, considered publishing it. But it would be very interesting about my time with this person because there were so many red flags that I missed. As I look back now, I can see all of them. But this whole control thing, if you're in a relationship with somebody who treats you that way, that's a no-no.
It's a very sad but beautiful story, because you also illuminate another point, which is that, you know, one ways of detecting that you're in the, I always say, you can diagnose narcissism with your gut, because your gut will tell you by way you're reacting. What was your first instinct, Justine? Yours was to blame yourself.
Right.
And when you find yourself being you don't even know that you're being unfair to yourself, but you notice that you're doing, like I noticed with my client, the narcissistic client, I noticed myself resorting to behaviors that were familiar to me when I was very little. So when you feel like you've suddenly dropped back into a time-warped state, you want to question that. And that might be a telltale sign that you're in a relationship
right.
with someone who's narcissistic. There's other ways, though, that control can show up in the dating world. And it can be even subtle control, where I call it the bait and switch, where the narcissist
okay.
might say something like, so what would you like to order? What do you, want red wine tonight? Should we go white? And you say, I really like white. Nope. You know what? You don't want white. You want red because we're going to have this amazing, in fact, let me order for us. You know, and so all of a sudden, you know, your whole preference, your thoughts, your ideas, your opinions, they just got, you know, they just got thrown out the door.
It's
and
so
if you
true.
Were already doubting yourself and whether or not you have any, you know, capacity to choose things in an appropriate way, well, now the narcissist has just proven to you that you're right, you can't.
Right.
You know, so it can
yeah,
also happen in these very subtle ways.
Yeah, and it is, and it can be subtle, right? This one happened to be overt.
Mm.
You know, I was, I mean, I just can't believe as I look back on it now that I even, you know, put up with that. But I did, and I learned from it. And
mm-hmm.
I actually really thank the universe, I thank God that he was in my life, because if he hadn't been, I would have not gone through the changes that I went through.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead
exactly.
of becoming the perfect victim after it was over, because I remember a professor of mine who was kind enough to see us together when his affair started, said to me when he walked out, when she told him I was in trauma, and he walked out, said to me, look, you're dealing with narcissistic personality disorder here. You need to go. And of course, I wasn't ready at that point in time to go, because I, what? I mean, this just happened. What are you talking about? But I learned, I didn't become the perfect victim, and I learned so much about my part in that relationship. And that's what I tell people all the time when I offer your book to people and I buy it for them, because I want them to understand what it takes to really communicate effectively and to see things that I didn't see for years, and then to get out gracefully and not become the perfect victim.
Good for you.
Because isn't it true that, you know, in all kinds of marriages, unless, you know, as they talk about people being drunk or drug addicts or whatever, you know, in marriage it takes two people. And, you know, if you're a true codependent and you're enabling these behaviors because of your own schemas or your own situations in life, then don't you have some responsibility? I lost a lot of friends over taking responsibility for the end of my marriage since he had an affair, because they wanted me to just blame him, and I wasn't going to do that, because then it was going to repeat itself all over again.
Right. Right.
That's what I believe happened.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'd like to share it because I want people to realize that there's a way out, and there's also a way to stay if you
absolutely.
Want to
absolutely. And that's
if,
another important point, too, because there are women who, I mean, some of the women from the support group I was facilitating for a while who were living with narcissistic partners, many of them would say to me when I would be going on a radio show or going out to give a lecture, they'd say, please make sure that your audience knows not to judge us so quickly. It's not so easy to walk away from a relationship, even though it's a narcissistic person who may be very cruel, but when you're going to leave your little ones with a guy who thinks it's okay to drink and drive, to not use seatbelts, to leave the kids alone while he falls asleep, you know, because he feels like it's all about him. That's
right.
a guy that I'm not ready to just leave, because we know that there's so many miscarriages of justice when it comes to what happens in the divorcing process with kids. And so it's not always such, it's just, there's not always these, like, easy solutions.
No.
And so a lot of these women will choose to try to figure out ways to make it work for as long as they can. Every day it's a new decision, perhaps.
Right. Right, and it's entirely up to them, and especially when there's kids involved. And they have my utmost empathy for going through that. You know,
yeah.
I would have hated if I had to deal with that. That would have been horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question. So if you realize that you are married to a narcissist, what's the first step to get them to treatment, or should I go for help first?
Neither one would be incorrect. I mean, starting out, I would say, on your own first in treatment may help to illuminate some of the issues that you're having in the marriage. Like, in other words, help you to anticipate how much leverage you might have. When I meet a woman first, or even a man first, who has a partner with narcissism, when I meet that non-narcissistic partner first, I spend a lot of time trying to figure out, do they have enough leverage to get the narcissist into treatment? Because if you don't have that, they won't go. So we assess the leverage, and then I try to assess with them, you know, how prepared are they to exit if things don't work out? I try to assess for danger, how unsafe or aggressive or abusive might this be, and what's at stake for them. So it's not a bad idea to have a consultation, even to sort of get a sense, is this a therapist that I think my partner, my narcissistic partner, is going to be able to work with? Because you know them very often better than anybody. But it's also not wrong to say, look, I've done my work. I've done a ton of work. I don't really feel like I need to be spending time now in therapy. And I would say that's fine, too. But make sure that whatever it is that you put out there, you are prepared to enforce it. You don't want to lose the opportunity to hold on to meaningful leverage, because therapy won't work. I know I sound like a broken record, but it's just the truth.
No, it really is. And the other piece, too, is if, let's say, I was still married to this person and I decided to go to therapy and get healthy, then how does that change, if you could tell people that are listening, the dynamics? Because it does. I mean, I would think it would probably mean the ending, possibly, of the relationship. Yeah.
Usually does. I mean, because, again, you know, while I wrote this book and it does have strategies that can be very effective for helping people to talk to their narcissistic partner in ways that can be helpful and maybe more effective and maybe even begin to influence some changes in the relationship. And that's always a really exciting thing when I hear people talk about that with me. But for the most part, you know, without some professional intervention, narcissists don't change. I mean, even with it, it's hard enough to get change.
Right.
But it's not impossible. And so, you know, I would just say that, you know, you want to be able to think very carefully through what it is that you're willing to do. If you go to therapy first yourself and you really start to see the light, and you start to learn about, you know, your own, perhaps, to use your term, Justine, codependency issues, what I would call self-sacrifice schema issues, when you start to learn about these parts of yourself, it's, you know, your health may begin to make you less and less tolerant of the situation at home. Because the more you become an advocate for that little person inside of you who has needs that have never been met adequately, the harder it is to go home to the space where you feel so lonely. It's hard to tolerate it.
Yeah. Because that,
you know,
is
some
very
people
lonely.
Call it the perils of therapy. You know, the perils of therapy are that you get healthy and then you can't tolerate the way things once were.
Yeah, it is a very lonely existence. I can attest to that. And so here's one more question: is there any relationship between narcissism and addictions? And I think you touched upon that before.
There's a huge relationship between narcissism and addictions, and that is, again, because they so often use, you know, whatever it is that they get attached to, they do it in a very exaggerated, excessive way. They find their drug of choice, be it pornography, spending, affairs, alcohol, the usual things, food. But they do it, again, in a very addictive, excessive way because it's a mode. Because it's, if they're not out there getting lots and lots of super special attention, then they swing in the other direction to places where they can keep their brain preoccupied, stimulated, distracted, under the influence.
Wow.
Anything to not feel the vulnerability underneath, anything to not feel the lonely, shameful little part of them that lives inside. So these are ways of just cutting off access.
It's incredible. Yeah.
It's very sad. It makes me very sad when I think about it, because it's such a lonely way to live.
Yes. Yes, indeed. It's very sad. And as a therapist, when I, you know, work with someone in therapy who has issues of narcissism, and I really see them coming about, but it's too little too late. You know, the partner has just grown tired of waiting. And I don't blame them. You know, I don't blame anybody who grows tired of this.
Right.
But on the other hand, I've watched someone who's working really hard and is now just driven everybody out of their life. Their kids aren't talking to them anymore. Their spouse is gone. They've lost their, you know, entourage of groupies at work. They become old, lonely people. It's very sad.
Yeah, it really is. So I wanted to, I can't believe that an hour and a half, we've got 5 minutes.
I know. Oh, my God.
So can you tell, what are you up to next, and what are you working on? Anything new coming up for you?
I'm actually under contract right now again with my publisher, with New Harbinger. They've invited me to write another book.
I'm so excited.
Writing a book now. Yeah, I'm writing. I speak a lot, so I enjoy speaking a little more than writing. Writing is quite tedious, but I'm writing another book now on, I'm just being honest, on
I'm right there with you.
Basically effective confrontation in a variety of settings. So it's really kind of expanding on the strategies that I wrote in Disarming the Narcissist, but beyond that to all kinds of populations. My itch, though, is also to begin thinking about a piece that would be written exclusively for narcissists themselves.
Right.
Because there's no such thing out there. So I think it would be really important to have something out there for the narcissist to read themselves, because some of them will actually pick up the books and read them. They may read them under the covers, but they'll read them.
Yes. Yes. And for a second, they will see some of it.
Yeah.
And as I noticed myself when I bought the book, The Wizard of Oz and Other Narcissists,
yeah,
I kind of gave it to my ex-husband and highlighted some things. And he did admit entitlement, but after that, he was off and running. Couldn't take it.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, I mean, that was
when
it.
When I give my book to narcissists, they usually take the book and they say, I know somebody just like this. Say, yeah, that was the idea.
That's the best. So, I hope that we can get you back on when that new book comes out, because I would love to have you back on. And if somebody wanted to listen to you talk or contact you, or what, do you have a website that people can go to?
I do. Yeah, for consultations, for speaking engagements, they can go to www.disarmingthenarcissist.com or just Google Wendy Beharry, and it'll take you right to my website.
That's terrific. Okay, it was so wonderful having you on.
I enjoyed this so much. I really had fun talking with you tonight.
I'm so glad. I really am, and I hope
to
have you back on.
I hope it was helpful.
Oh, I'm sure it was, and we will get feedback about it, and I'll let you know all about that
Thank
as well.
You.
So you have
Thank
a wonderful
Happy
holiday.
Holidays.
Yes, take care of yourself, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Take good care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
So I want to thank everybody for listening today. This was an incredible show. I want to thank Wendy again for being on. She really made this so special. And again, if anybody has any questions for Wendy, if you live in New Jersey, you want a consultation with her, you want to find out where she's speaking next, www.disarmingthenarcissist.com. If you haven't gotten that book, you can get it right on Amazon. That's where I buy them all the time. And it's a wonderful book. It absolutely helped me so much in my own relationship. So I want to tell everybody to just have a wonderful rest of a Sunday. Have a great week. We will not be on next week. Going to Washington, D.C. to see my family. We will be on the 20th. Not sure exactly what we're going to be doing yet. Hopefully some kind of Christmas show. I'm going to try to get Tom Nardone to do it with me. So have a wonderful Sunday. Please remember always to stay in the moment.